got action. We 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 got woo. We got action. We got action. We got woo. We got action. Now we got action. We got woo.
You are now tuned in to Intellectually Petty Radio. Hey, yo, Josh. We got action, homie.
And you are now tuned into another episode of Intellectually Petty Radio, brought to you by M3S3 Clothing. Men make moves and suckers stand still. And as always, on the mighty, mighty, mighty Nerve DJs Radio Network, man, I tell you, week after week after week after week, we only rock with legends over here. And today is absolutely no exception. We got, first off, father, activist, author, lawyer, Jesus Christ, philanthropist, just overall phenomenal human being, and senatorial candidate, Hill Harper. How you doing, King?
Oh, brother, it is great to join you. Great day, beautiful. So thank you for having me.
Yo, man, how's fatherhood?
Oof. You know, listen, I think a lot of people out there can relate, you know, being a parent. I'm a single parent. There's a lot of single parents out there. I just think even if you got two parents, it's not easy, you know, because the world we're in, there's so many influences and there's so many things that, you know, you want, you know, for me, I just think about, I want my child to just think of himself and be happy, you know, grow, learn, be curious. Curious, all those things. And quite frankly, in this world, there's a lot of things trying to steal a young person's curiosity and also trying to steal their innocence. And so I'm trying, you know, he's 8 years old and I'm trying to just let him be him to the best of my abilities, but also learn how to navigate life and hopefully build self-esteem and all of that. I mean, that's why, you know, 8 years ago, I moved to Detroit because I wanted to raise him here. I wanted him to grow up around the people here. Some of the best people in the world are here, you know, and I'd rather have him grow up with folks here than in Hollywood because just, you know, you just talk about just some of the greatest people. So hopefully that's coming into him via osmosis. Now, I'll tell you, it hasn't shown up yet because I do get calls from the school telling me to come pick him up because he's getting sent home. You know? So I'm like, man, why are you getting sent home? And so, you know, he does some things. He's got a lot of energy. Let's just put it that way. He's got a whole lot of energy. He's not necessarily the type of child that is meant to sit in a classroom. And he does not necessarily enjoy doing things that he's told to do. So there's a lot there. So, but you know, all the very experienced elders that I talk to say, listen, all that energy is going to serve him well when he develops a frontal lobe in his 20s. So,
and then you got to think about it, man. Like, what he's seeing is action.
That's right.
You got a lot going on. Yeah. And he's seeing this. And so, unfortunately, just like the elders you were talking about, you know, he hasn't found his outlet just yet, and he will.
And I hope so. I mean, and listen, if you get a chance for the listeners and the viewers to play my launch video, please play it because the whole launch video is about that relationship. Because when I was making my decision whether or not to run for U.S. Senate, the whole filter was my son and knowing that, you know, I was going to be really busy and there were going to be things and times that I wouldn't be able to do with him all the time and all of this, you know. But then I also thought, listen, him getting to see his father go for something that is so historic. There's only been, you know, 12 black U.S. senators in the history of this country. There's never been a black U.S. senator from Michigan. And, you know, I'm the first in over 2.5 decades. The first black Democrat on a U.S. Senate ballot in Michigan in over 2.5 decades. And so you know, he's seeing me go, and we even talk about it. He's like, what, you know, he's like, you're going to win. I'm like, man, you know, I'm number two in the polls. We got 99 days to become number one in the polls, you know? So I don't know. I tell him, I'm not sure. We're working as hard as we can though. And him seeing that kind of work, I think in an uncertain way, like there's no certainty, he gets it, you know? I think that hopefully that's going to seep in too, because he's seeing work and he's seeing going for something that's big and to try to make impact. Because he asked me, he said, why did you leave The Good Doctor? Because he loved me being on that show. He loved visiting the set. And I said, because I wanted to help people. And this, you know, U.S. Senate gives me an opportunity to help millions of people. And I, you know, playing a character on The Good Doctor is fine, but it's not helping millions of people like I could as a U.S. senator. And so he gets that. He got it. He may not agree with the choice, but he got it.
Well, I can see that. Let me ask you this. So in that vein of helping people, how do you connect the dots between, let's say, a rich white guy in Traverse City and a hardworking middle-class family in Detroit to offer something beneficial to both?
Right. Well, first of all, you know, we hear this rhetoric that of how divided we are. And I've been all 83 counties in Michigan. I've talked to so many different people from all different walks of life. And we aren't divided as much as we are disconnected. And, you know, I was talking to a farmer outside of Midland that was very staunchly going to, you know, was planning to vote for the 45th president this time around. And he said, man, I like you a lot. And I said, you know, tell me fundamentally, what do you want? Like, just what do you want? He said, you know what? I want a safe place for my kids to go to school where they can get a decent quality education. I want to affordable place to live and get a earn a living wage, and I want to be able to take a vacation every once in a while. And you know, speaking of young men, my son is awake when he should be asleep. What's happening? What's that? No, not yet. Soon. Go crawl back into bed, okay? I'll be up there in a second. Yes, you are. If you go into bed and close your eyes, you will go back to sleep, I promise. Pierce, just go into my bed. You don't have to lay, just go lay down on your own, okay? You see, you're getting a bird's eye view.
I have to, yeah, run. I thoroughly get it.
Come on. All right. I'm not sure where we left off, but I will.
You
say
were telling me about the farmer in Midland.
Yes. And I'll come back to a point I'll make about this, but I'll finish this story. So, farmer says, safe, quality place to send his child to school, affordable housing, living wage, healthcare, and just the ability to have enough money to take a vacation every once in a while with his family. I mean, you know, these just real nuts and bolts, really fam thing. And fast forward, I was talking to a single mom on the east side of Detroit. I said, what do you really want? She said, I want a safe and quality place to send my kid to school. I want affordable housing. I want a living wage. And I want just a good quality of life. And so fundamentally, we all basically want the same things, no matter who we are, where we're from, what it is. The question is, why have we been convinced to, number one, vote for very different folks and also be so segregated? You know, Michigan is extremely segregated.
Yes.
And part of my campaign is about unity. It's about bringing people together. It's about celebrating Dr. King's quote, where Dr. King said, "We're all tied together in a single garment of mutual destiny." If we all don't start to realize that we are inextricably linked, no matter if you're the farmer in Midland or somebody in Traverse City, Detroit, Flint, Muskegon, Bay City, Marquette, Sault Ste. Marie, Kalamazoo, doesn't matter. We're connected. Even if you're in Cleveland, we are connected. And so you help one person, it helps yourself. And we start to all rise together. And somehow, we can break down how, and I believe, I know how, and that's why I'm running to actually end it. But somehow we've allowed a small group of people to create villains for the purposes of maintenance of power and to moneyed interest. And so we have to break that. And we, the people, are the only ones that can break that.
Unfortunately, that seems like what this country has been built on.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm speaking more recently from the standpoint of many people think that the reaction to the Obama presidency was the Tea Party, but that was the beard. The true reaction to the Obama presidency was Citizens United in 2010, because if you're able to deem corporations as people, and you're able to allow unfettered, unlimited dark money in politics, then you're able to buy representatives and then threaten representatives. Because there's one thing that elected officials want more than anything, and that's to stay elected, right? Stay in power. And so Citizens United has basically created, particularly on the federal level, not in the same degree on the local level, but on the federal level, particularly Congress, we have a massive group in both parties that are bought and sold. And therefore, people know that intrinsically they have a sense, you know what? I don't even feel like the federal government has my back. And they're right. The federal government does not have the people's back. The Congress certainly doesn't. The representatives you keep electing don't. No. They have the back of the special interests, the lobbyists, and corporate interests, because that dark money is what keeps them elected. So therefore, they're beholden to that. And I'm running to break that. I'm running to get rid of Citizens United. I'm running for full campaign finance reform. I'm running to level the playing field, to get back to this idea of a participatory democracy. We're seeing our democracy crumble before our eyes because we're a decade and a half into the results of Citizens United.
I'm just curious, before you decided to run, when you had the first thought, like, what got you there? Like, were you just frustrated with things? Or, you know, like, what was the first inclination of, I want to run for a senator?
My grandfather, on both sides, I'm named after them. On my mother's side, his name was Doc Hill, Harold Hill. They called him Doc Hill. He was in Seneca, South Carolina. He had a pharmacy called Piedmont Pharmacy. He served the Black community during Jim Crow segregation. And then my grandfather, my father's side, was another physician. He was basically a family doctor, but OBGYN, but they didn't call it back then. And he was birthing Black babies for, different states all around. He was in the southernmost tip of Iowa on the Mississippi River. And he also had a farm. And both of those great men were leaders. My grandfather, my father's side, led the NAACP in Iowa. My grandfather on my mother's side was he was a pillar of the community. And we're here to serve. And there's so many people that have come before me and my family. My mother was one of the first Black female anesthesiologists in the country. My father was a psychiatrist who worked in the prison system. He created a thing way before its time called a conditional release program where you could get out early if with the condition, if you were a nonviolent or so-called nonviolent drug offender or so-called offender, you would get out early and you would participate in the program. Mm-hmm. This is way before its time. And these people are just heroes to me. They're my family. And I'm not the type of person who can see injustice and see wrongs that are clearly there, yet not too many people have the ability or the leverage to actually fight. And I may not have it, right? And listen, I'm going up against the establishment, right? And so, but I got a fighting chance. You know, I'm David, they're Goliath, and I still got 5 stones. Most people don't even have the stones, right? Because of a variety of circumstances. So who would I be with the first, truly open Senate seat in Michigan in, you know, decades, not going in to say, you know what? The U.S. Senate is the most powerful body in all of politics. In the context of a 50-50 Senate that we have now, an individual senator can make a real difference with for their constituency group. And I believe that there's a dearth of unbought leadership. And I won't be bought. I won't be bossed. I won't be bullied. And we're at a time when common sense people have to run for office. Just good, solid people who aren't going to create villains, who want to help the world. We got to run for office. And if I can inspire others to run for office as well that fit that profile, we will be able to save our democracy.
Yo, that's... When they tried to pay you to run against the congresswoman.
Yes.
Why did you go public with that?
You know, I went public because I got a call about it from a reporter to say, is this true? And I said it was a private call, so I'm not commenting. And then the comms person for my team was like, are you going to run the story whether he comments or not? They were like, no, if he doesn't comment and corroborate, we're not going to run it. I think that was the Washington Post or something. And so we said, great, thought it was done. Someone from there or wherever must have tipped off, because I think I can't remember who it was, Politico or something. And we did the same thing. I'm not going to comment on it. And then they said, well, you're going to run it either way? And they said, yeah, we're running this either way. And then we were like, well, you know, we're going to have to talk about it because I'm not going to let them say what the deal is. I was going to tell the truth, just exactly what happened. And that's what I did. And so, you know, it's interesting that, you know, I'm not going to name other names, but, you know, how many of the representatives and how many of these candidates have taken that deal, very similar deal, to try to target other candidates? So they were going to get a twofer with me. I was going to leave, you know, they wanted me to leave the Senate race against a candidate that they support for the Senate and then target a candidate that they want to get out of the House of Representatives, you know, and what's wild is folks think everybody's for sale because most people are, but they called the wrong one this time. And beyond that, I must say that the system itself is the one to blame. And let me explain what I mean. I don't blame the folks that made the call because they're just trying, they're advocating for their constituency group. Whether you agree with them or not or whatever, they're voraciously fighting for the group that they support. And listen, if they have resources and donors and the ability to fight for them, that's what they're doing. The system shouldn't allow it.
No.
The system should not allow that call to be made, but yet it does, because the folks at the top want that in place, because it creates such money, creates such a barrier to competition and such a barrier to entry of new candidates that they love the fact that Citizens United and dark money rules the day. And that's why we have to rally people. Because I say it all the time, corporations are not people. Money is not votes. Only people can vote. But people have to understand their power and understand the power of that vote and then come out and help elect people that will truly represent them and their interest.
Yo, I don't know if you really know how much respect you got in neighborhoods probably across this country for that. But like, you know, I've had conversations with people, oh man, I would have took the money, you know, in jest, or some people tell them the truth, but what they always do is I respect him.
Yeah.
You know, so that right there, man, I if nobody else tells you today, I'm proud of you.
No, well, I appreciate it. And what's funny is, based off some of the comments I've heard, you start to realize that we've gotten so used to the notion of people taking the money or doing the wrong thing as like the natural course of business that people like, oh, that can't be real. That can't be true, right? And because the normal thing is to, and someone even said this to me, it was a friend of mine who's from Russia. And we were just talking, he said, you know, I'm noticing America is becoming like Russia. And I was like, what do you mean? He said, well, you got to understand the culture in Russia is, you know, we're going to cheat you and it's your job to catch us. It's almost like your fault if you don't catch us cheating. You know, it's like, that's on you. You should have, because you should have known already we going to cheat. And he's like, I always felt America was like the right thing was to be honorable, not cheat, not do, you know. But now it's like, you know, everybody's, you know, got the take. Everyone's doing the backdoor deal. Everyone's, you know, and all of that. And so, you know, we got to get money out of politics. If we don't, I talk about this idea of degenerative democracy, you know, a democracy that continues to get worse. It degenerates. Where I've been working on a book called Regenerative Democracy, meaning a democracy that improves upon itself. And I believe there was a time, it was a very small window of time, where you saw our democracy in this country improving upon itself. And then we've gone through a cycle of degenerative. And I believe we can get it back. I believe we can create a new regenerative cycle, but it's going to take the people doing it. You know, the U.S. Constitution and the Michigan Constitution begin with the exact same three words, we the people. It doesn't start with we the party. It doesn't start with we the politician. It doesn't start with we the super PAC. It starts with we the people. And if we the people come and take control of our democracy again, we the people can dictate the future of this country.
I think we're seeing that to an extent on the college campuses today. And I don't really care what side, you know, like I'm not into which side, whatever. But the fact that this generation believes in something enough to say no more. Like my generation did. I was talking to somebody today. I don't think my generation did that. Like we had things that we did, you know, but it wasn't. We didn't protest like this.
Right. Well. For me, it reminds me of when I was in college, we did sit-ins and takeovers of college buildings for divestment from apartheid.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know if I would have called my mama and said Brown University told me that I wasn't getting my diploma, she would have whooped me up and that you did what? You sat where? But the point is that wasn't a threat that the administration made. I think that they understood that if there's anywhere that we want to have peaceful protests, sit-ins, takeovers, those types of things, as long as they're peaceful and they're not hate-filled. I do not condone in any way anti-Semitism. I do not condone Islamophobia. I do not condone hate speech. I certainly do not condone violence or threat of violence to anyone. I do condone peaceful protest. I don't condone intimidation protest. You know, there's a line there. And I also don't condone the idea of outsiders from the college ecosystem infiltrating. So to me, on a college campus, if you can help ensure that it's students from that institution attempting to show and protest and exercise their First Amendment rights, you know, that's to be celebrated. The other stuff that has hate speech, violence, no. And that's when I was at Brown, that's not what we were about, peaceful protests. We were about sit-ins. You know, I mean, it made people uncomfortable, sure. And it disrupted things, sure. That's what it's supposed to do, right? They couldn't use the offices. The president, you know, I mean, yes, disruption. But no one's getting hurt. No one's getting, you know, tased by the police. And ultimately, Brown University divested from companies that had interest in South Africa. And that happened because of student protest. And in many ways, a university is like a family. It's like a co-op, right? I think if you're a student at that university, you're an owner of it. You're an investor, you're a shareholder. Because you're a part of that, and you'll be an alumni shareholder. In other words, you're a part of the legacy. So therefore, you have the ability and the right to participate actively in the direction, the ethos, and the investment of that institution. And so it's not a private company, you know, or that kind of thing. It's different. It's different. So I look back on my years as an activist in college, and that's helped me. Brown University helped me become the person I am. There's no question about it. It was definitely the right place for me to go, but also protesting and, you know, marching sit-ins and about divestment was a part of it too.
I'm just curious, when you went back home and you said, I want to be an actor. How'd that go over?
You know, I give my parents a lot of credit on this one. They had always said, you know, there's nothing you can't do, right? And I think that they were fearful. I think that they were upset. I think that most parents want security and safety for their child. And you know, going out and pounding the pavement as an actor when you have two graduate degrees from Harvard is definitely not that. Waiting tables from 11 at night to 7 in the morning so I could audition during the day with those two grad degrees, you know, super overeducated waiter, was not
who
that.
Who hired you as a waiter with that, background?
I worked at a 24-hour diner. And let me tell you something. Some of the best people I've ever worked with in my life. In fact, they gave me a nickname. The Latino brothers I worked with, who were the busboys, they gave me a nickname Zapato, because it was 11 at night to 7 in the morning, and it got really busy after the clubs let out at around 2. And so it was busy from like 1:30 to about 3:30 or 4. That was like its busy time. And so between 11 and 1, it wasn't that busy. And then after 4 to 6 or 7 when I got off, it started getting busier in the morning again. People started trickling around 6. So there are these windows of time when it wasn't super busy. And I'd be sitting there like reading a play, you know, or standing at the counter. And they were trying to take up the rubber mats after the busy time. They'd be like, Zapato, Zapato, like move your feet, man. And they just started calling me Zapato. So, you know, you just talk about good, hardworking people that I just love. And they had dreams. I mean, we all have dreams. We all have goals. You know, I actually texted with one of the folks I worked with just a bit ago. I'm not in contact with the rest of them, but, you know, this is what America and so many of us are, right? Folks that, you know, have to work this job or this hustle to try to do this over here because we want to achieve this and we're setting this up for that. and that's okay. Particularly if we help each other get there. That's my goal. I want to help you, everybody. And remember, those federal dollars that senators control, that's your money. It's not the government's money. It's our money. It's your money. It's the taxpayers' money. So that money should be coming back to you in the form of an investment in you and your community and your family to make your lives better, not worse. And that's the kind of leader I want to be.
You win. First bill you sponsor.
Universal health care. We got to get health care done. And my health care bill will include mental health care, dental, vision, full. If you get sick, you have a right to see a doctor. Right now, health care, the number one cause of personal bankruptcies is catastrophic medical. One third of all GoFundMes is medical care related. GoFundMe is not a health plan. Right here in Michigan, we just had 450,000 people lose their Medicaid. 100,000 facing life-threatening illnesses. I'm a cancer survivor. I understand what it's like to be in the hospital system. We pay the most for prescription drugs of any developed country in the world. Just if you go 12 miles from where I'm sitting right now across the Ambassador Bridge, you're paying 13x less for a vial of insulin. So I want to make sure that we can negotiate our prescription drug prices for everybody. So, it's there for us to do. We got to get that done. And there's a whole John Lewis Voting Rights and Advancement Act. We have to re-up the Civil Rights Act of 1965. We have to get our voting rights to stop this gerrymandering and all the things that are happening with voter manipulation and all of that. We got to codify women's reproductive health, women's reproductive freedom federally. You see what's happening in many states. Obviously, whether we're talking about what's trying to happen in Ohio or Florida or wherever, we have to codify that federally. And I want to pass the PRO Act, to be honest. The PRO Act supports unions, strong unions, gives the National Labor Relations Board real teeth, gives OSHA real teeth. I'm a huge union supporter. I'm a 32-year union member who was elected to the national board of my union. We're already down to 6% union membership in the private sector. That has to go way back up. If you look at communities that had the lowest amount of wealth gap, they're the highest union communities, right? So we have to undergird and support unions. And you've seen the success the UAW had this past year. We need to double down on that and expand it.
And just for all my healthcare professionals out there, it is appalling how many nurses or STNAs or housekeepers go broke trying to pay for healthcare. Mm-hmm. I had heart surgery 4 years ago, and without my parents' help, I don't know where I'd be.
Yeah,
and I've been a nurse for 3 decades.
Mm. Yeah, both of my parents are doctors, and first of all, I think that all healthcare professionals are heroes. I was out there with the nurses. There was nurses striking here in Michigan last year, and I went out twice to their strike lines to support them. We have to support each other, and we have to be there for each other. And I was at a senior facility today, assisted living facility. The level of understaffing and underpay for these workers working in these assisted living facilities is the point that we have for-profit healthcare. We don't have a healthcare system. We have a sick care system. And the incentives are all wrong because people say, well, Hill, how are you going to pay for universal healthcare? I'm going to say, we're going to reverse the incentives is what we're going to do. We're going to incentivize the profiteering to be keeping people healthy. And all of a sudden, these same folks are going to be sending you vitamin D3 and vitamin C and kale and smoothies because they're going to get paid more if you don't have a treatment, right? And we reverse the incentives because right now, their incentive to treat you the least with the fewest amount of staff and to make sure that you stay on meds and or have procedures because that's how they're making their money. Spend the least, have you spend the most in terms of treatment. So I agree with you. We can get it done. We can get it solved. But to do all of this, I'm going to have to be the 51st vote to end the filibuster. We're not going to get it done with the filibuster. And we're going to have to get rid of that. And the fact that Kristen Sinema did not get that done, it's a shame. And I'm, you know, my opponent in this race keeps talking about reform the filibuster. You don't reform it. You have to end it. It's a holdover from slavery anyway. No.
Okay, do me a favor. Dumb that down for me, the filibuster. Okay.
So basically, you need to pass any legislation, whether it's women's reproductive freedom, whether it's the John Lewis Voting Rights Amendment, whether it's universal health care, whatever it is, you need 51 votes. You need a simple majority out of 100. But the kicker is, to end debate, you need 60 votes. So it used to be way back in the olden times, there was debate on the Senate floor and they were speaking and da 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 da. And then, you know, someone could stay out there for days, you know, talking about it. And to have them stop and be quiet, you needed 60 votes to stop the debate, to call a vote. Mm-hmm. And so now they don't even do that anymore. You don't go out and talk. They just threaten the filibuster, which means they need 60 votes, and they know they could never get 60 votes. So the thing never gets voted on, whatever the issue is. It never gets brought to the floor because a filibuster was threatened. And so to start to pass these really big tentpole pieces of legislation, you're going to have to get rid of that 60-vote requirement to end the filibuster. And it just takes a majority vote to end, you know, in other words, you can get rid of the filibuster with 51 votes. You know, you don't need 60 votes to get rid of the filibuster. You just need 51 votes to get rid of it.
Oh, that's so confusing. Your youth ambassador, Kid J. How did you come to have a youth ambassador, and how did you pick Kid J?
You know, I think that having young people who have real voice in the campaign is a critical piece, because I know that, you know, I'm going against an establishment candidate who, if I don't have young people, if I don't have new people into the process, then there's no way I can win. You know, when you have high turnout, there's high turnover. Low turnout means the incumbent or establishment and or establishment candidates tend to win. And so I wanted to have as many young people around the campaign, as a part of the campaign as possible. And he's just an amazing ambassador. He has energy. I got a lot of energy. He's got a lot of energy. He has talent, and he shows it. And he also has a beautiful heart and spirit. And so it's a perfect synergy. And I couldn't be more grateful to him being our youth ambassador.
Good people too, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
like they're family. So, you know, I've got a chance to kind of see him in action, and you are absolutely right. And then some.
Yes.
Dude is just, I could go on and on. Is there anything that you want to leave people with? Because I know I only got X amount of time. I don't want to leave
you too long. At the end of the day, folks got to remember that there are 100 senators in this country, and anything that they pass applies to you. So, you know, I'm not running to be Michigan's governor. I'm running to be a United States senator from Michigan. And if you want representation and you like what you've heard, I could use your support. I can't win without support. It could be $2, $5, $10. You could go to hillharper.com and just get the smallest donations, or, you know, a small donation that encourage a friend or a group of friends or 10 friends. You know, movements get built through word of mouth. And anybody you know in Michigan that you think might be supportive, call them and tell them, hey, you know what? Listen to this, Brother Hill Harper. Send him this. You know, I liked what he had to say. Figure out a way to support him. You know, we have 95 days to build a movement to win a U.S. Senate seat. It's unprecedented opportunity. And we can bring real representation. Remember, Shirley Chisholm said, if you don't got a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. And what she was trying to say is, you have to have a seat at the table. You have to. We have to. And right now, we do not, in this kind of way that I'm going to bring it. And And I like to say, if you don't see the table, then you're on the menu. That means you're not placing orders, you're being ordered. And right now, too many of us are being ordered rather than placing orders. And this will give us an opportunity to place some orders.
Oh, man. First off, my daughters absolutely love you. They rarely give a crap about who I interview. I'm like, I'm interviewing Hill Harper. Oh, really? But anyway, I can't possibly thank you enough. If there's anything that I could ever do for you, bruh, please just say the word and I got you.
Well, thank you. Just spread the good word, hillharper.com. And then even my socials, repost my socials. That helps the algorithm. You know, all that stuff helps, you know. We're in this together, just like Dr. King said. I really mean that. And don't think anything positive that you can do, you know, in these next 95 days for this campaign, please just it all matters because it all builds upon itself. And I can't thank folks enough because I literally it's not about sending Hill Harper to the Senate. It's about us walking into the Senate together.
On that note, Matt, I'm gonna let you go. I know Pierce is waiting on you.
That's right.
Hey, man, love the kids, man. Trust me, I have been there. You have a phenomenal evening.
God bless.
And I'm rooting for you, bro.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
No doubt, man. Have a good one. Yo, come on, bro. Hill Harper, the future senator from the great state of Michigan, Hill Harper. This has been Jobs. This has been another episode of Intellectually Petty Radio. You already know, man. We only rock with legends over here. And y'all have a good one. On that note, and shout out to his assistant, Wanda. Shout out to my guy over at Diamond Cut Management, who really helped me out. This wouldn't have happened without him. Like, I've been wanting to interview Hill Harper for the longest, and he made it happen in a day. Shout out to you. Shout out to Kid Jay. The whole family over that way. On that note, man, I'm out of here. Y'all have a good one. Peace.